So then that brings us to our round 10 pick and a player who I genuinely believe there's no way he should have still been there. And, you know, next to Springer, this was probably my second favorite pick of the draft. And that was Hanley Ramirez.
November and the waning sun, and all the proofs I'd like to prove, we go down tonight.
Good evening and welcome to episode 78 of Flags Fly Forever, a baseball prospectus fantasy podcast. I am your host, Brett Sayer, and with me, as always, is Mike Gianella and George Bissell. This is a very special episode. We are going to be talking about our mixed labor draft, which we had on Tuesday night. So for those of you expecting us to talk about outfielders, you are going to have to wait until next week, which is fine because our coverage of outfielders will be continuing through next week at Baseball Prospectus. So, Mike, how are you feeling in the continued afterglow of our draft?
You know, I joked that it's tough to now be the defending champions and we've started anew, but, and everybody says this, and we'll get into this, I like our team. I like the way our team came out, and in terms of the potential of the team, I feel as good about this team as I felt about last year. So we know that things can go badly, and you know, you could finish in seventh or eighth as easily as you could finish first, but the core we put together is very good.
I agree. So we are going to talk all about this team. We're going to talk to each other about it. We're going to talk to George a little bit about it to get some outside opinion. We are going to probably answer some questions about it. So let's kick things off right after we take care of the pleasantries. So you can read all of us at baseballprospectus.com. You can find us on Twitter. I am at Dynasty Guru. Mike is at Mike Gianella. That's G-I-A-N-E-L-L-A. And George is at George Bissell. Two S's and two L's. You can reach us via email at flagsflyforever@baseballprospectus.com. And rate and review us on iTunes or Stitcher. So with that, we will be right back. And welcome back. So we did this last year as well, and we are doing it again this year. We did it again this year. We recorded a 20-minute or so segment before labor, on Labor Eve, about what we were thinking the night before the draft and where we thought the draft would take us. So now that we know where our team is and all of it is out there for everyone, we can listen back and see how little you can actually predict about a fantasy draft. Without any further ado, this is Mike, Brett, and George from 3 days ago. So here we are in the past. This is 24 hours right now to labor. We started this last year and it was kind of fun. And we decided that we were going to try to do it again. So we are sitting here on Labor Eve and we are going to talk about what we think might happen in labor tomorrow. I'm going to kick it out to Mike real quick to talk about where we are in the draft and what some of our thought process has been so far on what our first round pick might look like.
Yeah, so we have the 7th pick overall. Last year we had the 15th, which eliminated a lot of guys. But one of the things we liked about that was the fact that we were on the wheel and could kind of – last year we took Ian Desmond and Troy Tulowitzki, and it didn't really work out. But we were able to kind of, you know, drown the pool with the shortstops. Being in the middle, we can't do that, so there's less of that strategy. But so at the 7, you know, we know we're not going to get Mike Trout, Paul Goldschmidt, or Bryce Harper. They're going to go 1 through 3. We know it's very unlikely that we're going to get Clayton Kershaw. He should go 4. Maybe he'll slip to 5. I really doubt he'll be there at 7. We'd certainly take him. So what we're looking at, we're kind of looking at either Manny Machado or Josh Donaldson. Donaldson right now ranks higher in ADP. We actually prefer Machado. We're hoping to get one of the guys. We're looking at third base and how it drops off after those two, Chris Bryant and Nolan Arenado. So we're hoping that the teams above us don't swipe both. We think someone will take one of them. We really doubt that both of them will go.
Yeah, the way that that happens is if no one in the top 6 or no one in the 4 to 6 range is one of the Correa buyers. That's the most likely name to jump in there, I would think, right, Mike?
Yeah, I would think so. That's probably the scenario that's going to play out, I would think, if you know it doesn't go our way necessarily. We did talk a little bit, you know, if both those guys go, you know, we did talk a little bit about Jose Altuve at the 7, which is kind of aggressive. But as much as I like him, Rhett's ranking is lower. And also there's enough speed in the auction and we have some preference rankings that we don't necessarily think we need to go that route in the first round.
Yeah, the guy who, you know, if those two third basemen are off the board, the guy who I think we'll focus squarely on is Andrew McCutchen, who is outside of the 1 month of last year has been one of the safest high-end fantasy players in baseball for, what, the last 5 years? Mm-hmm. So I don't think he's started his decline yet. I think it's a reasonably safe pick there.
Yeah, and you know, the thing about that month is, you know, he was hurt, and there was a report just today, and today's Monday as we're talking, that, you know, he should be fine. He says he's completely healed. A big part of the drop in his value were the steals. You know, if he's a 20-20-plus guy in both those categories with the batting average, he's a top 5 or 6 guy, and I think some people are discounting him a little bit as a result.
Yeah, just to put some numbers on what you guys are talking about, through May 19th, he was hitting 225, 321, 370 with 4 home runs and 2 steals. That's in his first 38 games. From May 20th on, he hit 313, 426, 526 with 19 home runs and 9 steals in his final 523 plate appearances. So he was really good from about May on.
Yeah, he's Andrew McCutchen. That's what he does.
Yeah, and he's one of those things. He's not post-prime, or he's not so old. You know, he's not old. I mean, he's right where he should be, you know, in terms of being a stud. And, you know, if anything, I could see a scenario where the steals drop a little bit, but the power comes on a little bit as well. I have no – if he's there for us with the 7 and we don't get one of the third baseman, I have no problem with making him our centerpiece this year.
Could not agree more. Let's go down to what we think. It's less of a fun conversation this year than last year because we were on the turn and we could kind of discuss what we wanted to do with two picks. Where our second round pick this year is 24th overall.
23, I believe.
20, yeah, to be 23, 24. One of those picks. Yeah. So it's a lot harder to figure out where we are going to be with that pick. But judging from where some players are going and where we have them ranked, I think our second pick is likely to be either Buster Posey or Jose Bautista.
Yeah. The one guy who could slip, his NFBC is 22, and we have the 23 is Jose Abreu. Mm-hmm. The other guy who could slip if there's the aversion to speed is D. Gordon. But yeah, I think Gordon's going to be gone before we get there. So yeah, it'll probably be Abreu, Batista, or Posey.
Yeah, I think
it's a possibility, but I think it'll be one of those three.
Yeah, I think that's a pretty safe bet that, well, not a safe bet because someone could always drop, but I think the if we were betting, it would be between one of those three guys there.
Yeah.
So rather than talk about spend too much time on that, I thought it might be a good idea to go through where some of the players we have talk about some of the players we have ranked a bit higher than consensus or current ADP, and see whether that puts us in a better position to get them, or whether we think there's going to be some pull in the room for some of these guys as well. So Mike, who are a couple of these guys as we kind of move into just the top 50 overall, the top 100, who are some of these players who you think there's a better than normal chance that we might get?
Well, if we go with the top 50, the guy that we're most aggressive on is Lorenzo Cain. He's currently 52nd in ADP. I'm more aggressive on him than you are, but you're still above where he's at. I wrote about him in the Target piece today. You know, I made the point that he earned $2 fewer than Jose Altuve in 15-team mix, even when you factor in the position scarcity. Even if that power slips a little bit this year, Kane's just a really good player. He's finally healthy. He's finally showing what he can do. You know, I've discounted him for the risk, but even discounting him, I just feel like he's somebody I'd love to get, you know, if he's sitting there for us in the third round. And judging by the ranking, he could be there in the fourth round. You know, a couple other guys we're higher on are Adam Jones, who we have 17 slots higher on average than ADP. Robinson Cano, who we have 14 slots higher. And Carlos Gomez, who we have 13 slots higher. So I think there's a few guys up there in the top 50 that – you know, we kind of like better than the consensus. And, you know, there's a chance, I'd say, based on how things shake out, that we probably get two of them. Although, as I pointed out before, all it takes is like one or two people, you know, to kind of like a guy like we do. And, you know, that doesn't really matter.
Yeah, that's definitely true. You know, the funny thing about Lorenzo Cain is that we have him in our consolidated rankings. We have him just outside the top 30. And, I'm terrible doing this math off the top of my head. We pick at 37, yep. Right? That's our third round pick. So that is, I think it's probably, if I had to bet on a particular player going at a particular draft slot for us, it probably would be Lorenzo Cain in the third round.
It'll probably be Cain in the third unless Charlie Blackmon slips. You know, Charlie Blackmon's ADP is 36. And we have the 37. We've kind of seen, you know, we saw this last year, we got him. There's kind of this disdain for Blackmon, and I think even this year there's this disdain for him, you know, despite the fact that he was, what, like a top 10 or 15 player overall last year, according to
both of the last 2 years.
Right. You know, that's the thing. Blackman's been so good, and there's this disdain for him. He could, if it's not Kane, we'll get Blackmon. So it's likely we're going to get a big, you know, speed guy with some power in the third round. Which I think is part of the reason why I'm willing to just, you know, say bye-bye to Altuve there as well.
Yeah. Last year, three guys hit 300 with 15 home runs and 25 steals. Cain was one of them. You guys know who the other two are?
Altuve make it?
Yep, you got them both. AJ Pollock and Jose Altuve.
Yeah, Altuve just got to 15 home runs. Well, I know that because I wrote the Target piece on him. And yeah, Pollock was a monster as well. And he's being discounted a little bit, but not nearly to the same degree.
Yeah, but the point is, Cain in the third round is essentially like having another first or second round pick, given the production he's likely to get.
I mean, if he performs, yeah.
Yeah, that's very true. But we certainly like him. Mike, let's keep going down. Who are some other players that we are higher on than consensus here?
Well, if we scan down into the top 100, the biggest one, and you know, George is going to groan at this, and I actually tweaked our rankings to kind of like push for him, is Ian Desmond. Ian Desmond right now is going about 115 in ADP. Brett's really high at him. He has him at 82. I tweaked him up after initially having close to ADP to 94. So we're like almost two rounds on a 15 team ahead on him. So I would suspect he'll be there for us. Another guy we both like is Gregory Polanco. I know the power hasn't quite been there yet, but he's just such a good athlete, and I really see some growth with him. And I like taking guys like this who, you know, if they don't grow, fine, they'll produce where you draft them, but there's room for, you know, there's room for a spike.
Yeah, Polanco is a perfect example of that, because, you know, there is power potential with Polanco, and there is batting average potential with him too. But even if he doesn't reach that, you're talking about a guy who is going to put himself in pretty good shape for 30 steals, which is really, I mean, at that point, you know, just we have him 77th overall. So that's perfectly fine as long as there's other stuff.
Like our formula last year, and I could see mirroring it, we'll be getting like a guy like Blackmer Kane in the third, getting a guy like Polanco, not having a Hamilton or a Revere, but having a baseline of a team that has like guys with some power that can also steal 25 to 30 bases apiece. You know, we did that with Blackman. We did that with a couple other guys last year, and it worked really well.
Mm-hmm. I agree. So let's do the converse. Who are some of the biggest differences on the negative side in the top 100 between our rankings and consensus? Who are guys that we, you know, it's really hard to say we won't end up with any of these guys, but I'd say it's extremely unlikely given where we have them.
Well, right. I mean, the biggest two are the young shortstops, Corey Seager and Francisco Lindor. I'm a little bit more down on both of them than you are, but your rankings are also fairly negative. And, you know, I think our feeling about them, you know, this is the difference between labor, which is a redraft, and a dynasty league. You know, obviously in a dynasty league, you want these guys, you especially want Seager, but I mean, in a redraft, you know, Seager has, what, 110 at-bats or plate appearances last year? He could be great, but people are paying him like he will be, you know, like a shade or a couple shades below Carlos Correa. So we're kind of just avoiding those guys based on how we have them ranked, and we'll probably wind up with a shortstop in the mid-rounds, I'm guessing.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see. Who else is there? Danny Salazar, who's we have 97th overall, is 19 slots behind ADP. You know, it's funny. There aren't quite as many big gaps. The other two big ones, I think these are both interesting guys. Jose Fernandez, we have ranked 17 below where their ADP is, and Kyle Schwarber. And it's not a case of your ranking or my ranking being all that different. I'm a little bit lower on Schwarber than you are, and you're a little bit lower than I am in Fernandez, but I have a feeling for the same reasons that we're kind of wary on these guys. Not that we don't think they'll be good. We have them in the top 50, but they're being drafted like in or close to about 30. And I feel like in Fernandez's case, because of innings and how much he'll actually throw, or the fact that he hasn't thrown a lot, you know, and Schwarber in that his average kind of, you know, dropped a little bit. And this is an average league, not an OBP league. That, you know, I didn't want to get too, we don't get too aggressive with these guys. Someone else will wind up with them.
Yep, that's exactly what I was going to say there. So I will not repeat you.
Yeah, I think I'm looking at you in the top 100. I think that's it for guys that are 15 or lower than, you know, where we have the next guys I see are like Archer and Carrasco who are lower. You know, it's funny because it might sound like we're down on pitching, but it's more that the market's aggressive on pitching. We've got some ideas. You know, we've been talking about this because I've done a couple mocks. I could foresee if Jake Arrieta doesn't fall to us in the second, and I don't think he will, I could see our staff being like a Matt Harvey, Adam Wainwright, like top of the staff, just based on how our rankings are and how some of these mocks have gone.
Yeah, and I'd be totally comfortable with that. Yeah. I think we're both on the similar page about both Harvey and Wainwright being pretty good values here.
But
let's look. Go ahead.
No, I was going to say, just to, you know, to your point, just to close on all these ranks, you know, as we know, you know, we wound up with Justin Upton last year, and we weren't targeting him at all. So you never know how these drafts are going to shake out. There could be somebody in the third or more likely the fourth or fifth round who, you know, we're neutral on but just winds up falling.
Yeah, I mean, we had, if you would have asked us at this time last year whether we thought we were going to pay the price for Gerrit Cole, I'm sure the answer pre-draft would have been no, because he was going quite a bit higher than I think we felt comfortable with. Yeah. But he fell to a comfortable spot in our rankings, and that is that's how that stuff happens. Upton and Cole were two guys that we liked, but nowhere near as much as we thought we were going to need to like them to get them. So you can never predict these drafts, even right home league drafts, expert drafts. You can never predict it. So let's go a little bit deeper outside of the top 100 and hit on one or two players that we also think we are. We have a better than average shot of getting, and I want to start two guys jump out to me on the positive side here, who are Shin-Soo Chu and Dustin Pedroia. And you know, this sort of is not surprising at all. If you know Mike and myself, we go where the value is, and the value doesn't quite tend to be with the 30-something-year-old hitters. So, you know, I choose going ADP of about 129 right now. We both have them just a shade outside of the top 100. I'd say that there's enough there that I think there's a pretty good chance we could land him, which would be absolutely fine with me. I think I'm a big supporter of Chu this year. And then Pedroia is a little bit more interesting case. We have him a bit lower down. We have him inside the top 150, whereas consensus and ADP have him outside the top 150. Mike, I'm a touch higher on Pedroia than you, but we're both well ahead of the public mark. What is it about Pedroia this year that makes you a little bit more confident in him, or is it just that the hate's gone a little bit too far there?
It's probably more the latter, but it does seem that, you know, he's healthy. I don't think he's going to run quite as much as he has in the past. So I think where we have him ranked is appropriate, but I can see the average coming back. I can see enough power coming out of him, and I can see a full season out of him that, you know, kind of makes him, you know, the value based on where he's being ranked. You know, I think that's the main thing, though, Brett. People have pushed him too far back, and they've pushed him so far back that I look at it and I look at some where, you know, some of these other second basemen are being ranked around him, like DJ Mayhew, you know, and a couple others ahead of him. You know, Addison Russell's a good example. Addison Russell, now granted, he has shortstop eligibility, but he's ranked well ahead of Pedroia. And again, as much as I love Addison Russell long-term, and I think we've talked about this with him, you know, we don't know how much growth he has in his projection, particularly his batting average. You know, one of the things with us in labor last year is that we, you know, almost got killed and lost the lead because our batting average was just not there for us. We don't want to overcompensate with that, but, you know, I do think Pedroia would be a nice, you know, batting average anchor if we got him.
It would. And when it comes to tiebreakers, I always appreciate a player who comes out and says they're going to steal more bases this year. You never know how often that's really going to work out, but it's always, you're better off hearing a player say it than not hearing a player say it.
The other guy I'd say on the positive side of the top 150 is my perennial favorite, Lucas Duda. So, you know, we'll see how that goes.
Yeah. He's a guy who, Mike, you have him well. I mean, it worked out well for us last year, so it may work out well for us again this year. Yeah. You have him well ahead of
23 spots ahead of where you have him, and I still have him
above ADP. Though. Yeah,
are you guys gonna take the Carter Capps plunge?
It's possible.
We'll see.
I wouldn't rule it out.
I'd be excited if you did.
I know you would. So that's more or less it. Is there, before we go, do we have any particular, theory of what's going to happen with closers, this time around? We've had some interesting experiences with closers in the draft. Do you think we get a closer in the first six rounds?
Six or seven. What I see happening this year in the mocks is that even though the closers at the bottom are weaker, they're going a little later, but I suspect that labor will be aggressive. But I do think we've got a couple guys like Harris Familia and Mark Melanson that we're a little bit higher on than the crowd. And I think based on how our averages are shaking out, I think we will at least get a top tier, top 10 closer, maybe top 12, I'd say in the first 8 or 9 rounds. So, yeah, I think we get a closer this year unless the room goes nuts for closers. And then we'll do what we did last year. We'll get value elsewhere and, you know, let people overpay for that category. But I think we get one.
Yeah. Well, then we might end up with Carter Capps. More realistically, we'll probably end up with AJ Ramos in like the 17th round, something like that.
Yeah. Or we wind up with, you know, like with one of the Seattle guys. We won't get C-Sheck. Don't worry. I know you hate him, George.
Yeah. So that is all of our pre-labor predictions. We are now going to go back and cram for the last 24 hours of this thing. And when you hear this, the next part of this podcast will be talking about how prescient we actually were. And that will be that. So now back to the future. And now we are back in present day, back to Thursday evening post labor. It's always an interesting exercise, but now we can talk about what actually happened. So, Mike, should we start from the top? Should we go over some generalities first? Do players? How do you want to handle this?
Let's just start from the top and to go back to what we talked about 3 days ago. We did get our guy. We were talking about Manny Machado and Donaldson as a fallback, and as it turned out, we didn't have to worry about it because the first few picks were very predictable. The top four were what you see in drafts everywhere: Mike Trout, Paul Goldschmidt, Bryce Harper, Clayton Kershaw. The first curve, which helped us, was Steve Gardner of USA Today took Anthony Rizzo at 5th overall, which I think some people think is a stretch. But if you look at Rizzo, he's kind of a slightly poor man's Paul Goldschmidt minus the average. I think that's perfectly fine. So we knew we were getting Machado or Donaldson. We thought that Ray Murphy of Baseball HQ would take one of those guys. But he took another third baseman, Nolan Arenado. So we had a moment where we discussed Machado or Donaldson, but we very quickly decided that we wanted our guy, and that Machado was that guy.
Yeah. So we talked a lot about the decision making that went into Machado on the pre-show. Should we call it the pre-show? But it was really, really exciting to actually get him because there was certainly concern that he would not make it there. That was that. We kind of had some names in mind for who we thought we might be going after in round two, and it turns out we got none of them because our ace from the 2015 draft. From the 2015 version of our team fell to us at 24 overall.
There were a few hitters that we were kind of looking at. We had our discussion about D. Gordon higher on taking speed earlier than Brett is, but Gordon went early enough to Mike Podhorzer of Fangraphs that conversation went out of the way. We would have really liked Buster Posey with that pick at 24, but he was taken earlier. The guy we thought we might get, we had ranked higher, was Jose Bautista before us to Jake Seeley. So he didn't snake us exactly because I could have lived without him. But at that point, the other players we liked, like Charlie Blackman, like Lorenzo Cain, we thought we might get those guys in the third round. They really felt like a reach in the second. So we went with our board. We took Jake Arrieta. And I've heard some criticisms on other podcasts, and I think on SiriusXM there were some criticisms that we were reaching, trying to bring the band back together, that, you know, we succeeded with him last year, so he was a comfort pick. But honestly, even knowing the limitations with Arrieta, if he puts up a high two this year, you know, Pakoda's saying about a 3-1, but if he puts up a high two this year with a solid whip and the strikeouts, he's fine there. He's fine for me as a number two. I'm comfortable with it.
Yeah, I mean, he was – is it fair to say that he was clearly the number three starting pitcher on both of our boards coming into the draft?
Both individually. Yeah, he was for me. I think Chris Sale is a better pitcher, but that doesn't take into account the AL versus NL difference mm-hmm. as far as ERA goes. And in terms of fantasy, yes, he was my clear number three.
He was mine as well. And yeah, there was really, you know, for me, there was, you know, there, I can only speak for myself for this and not for Mike, but I play in so many leagues that there is no bringing the band back together. There's just players, and I own almost everyone somewhere. So if there's a bringing the band back together team, it's probably a 200 player team.
I feel like you're cheating on me now, Brett, because I'm only in like four or five leagues. So I feel dirty.
Yeah, I think this year I'm finally going to whittle it down to single digits, but I probably won't end up being successful at it.
Well, the other thing about Arrieta that I, in terms of the criticism, part of the rationale of that pick, labor and expert drafts have been very pitching aggressive. And part of the reason I had him ranked where we had him ranked was knowing that if someone took him earlier, fine, I would take the hitter, you know, that we had ranked at that slot, and it would have been one of the hitters I mentioned. If someone didn't take Arrieta, other pitchers would go, and I didn't want to be in the position where we took a hitter who we had ranked a little lower, like say someone like Chris Davis probably would have fit in there, and then look at a pitching run and be like, okay, so now we're taking Davis, who I've ranked a few slots lower, and we're either passing on pitchers because they're all ranked too low, or reaching for a pitcher who doesn't have as much value as Arrieta. So that was a large part of the thinking.
Yeah, I mean, realistically, if we had gone off our board and taken a hitter rather than Arrieta, we would not have gotten a pitcher until we would not have gotten a starting pitcher until the 10th round.
Yeah, probably. You know, and the thing about that is we talked, and I think we talked about this in the pregame, we talked about a possible Matt Harvey, Adam Wainwright combo. So maybe if we don't get Arrieta, we get Harvey in the third. He was taken one pick after our third round pick, again by Jake Seeley. But Adam Wainwright, surprisingly, you know, we thought we were going to get him because my ranking was more aggressive than Brett's, and Brett's ranking was pretty fair. Wainwright went in the sixth round before it got back to us. You know, I think he came back to us in the sixth round. We would have considered him at that slot, but he went five picks before a pick. So, yeah, back to that point, people were very aggressive with pitching. But in the context of this draft, I think he's a pretty solid value.
Yeah, I actually was looking at that backwards. I think maybe you're right. I think maybe we would have ended up with Harvey in the third. I thought I was looking at it going right to left instead of left to right. But, you know, the funny thing is that you never quite know how these things are going to shake out. On my, you know, we have our consolidated rankings, and I have my own rankings that went into that equation. The Arrieta was 23rd on my individual rankings. This is the 24th pick. It was almost entirely chalk from my rankings. And the only player who was ranked higher than Arrieta who was still available with that pick was the guy who we ended up taking with our next pick, because for some reason he fell another 15 spots for reasons that I cannot explain for the life of me. And that is George Springer. And this is probably my favorite pick of the draft.
This was, you know, we had this happen last year. Last year, we call this our Upton moment, because last year, Brett had Justin Upton ranked higher than I did, but I had him ranked around ADP. So our consolidated average on Upton was like five or six slots above where he was. Now, the difference this year we were in the middle of the draft, so there weren't quite as many extremes. So last year with Upton, by the time he got to, I think it was our 40th pick, we had this – we were almost looking at each other over the Skype call or the call being like, how could Justin Upton still be here? He's like 10 slots behind ADP, and if you don't like Justin Upton, he's a bargain. It was similar with Springer. I'm not the biggest fan of Springer, but you reach a point where the middle of the third round, the 37th pick for someone whose floor barring injury is 2020, how do you pass that up? And there was no way that we could pass that up.
No, there was definitely no way. He was clearly the best player on our board, and you know, I have, like you said, I had him pretty aggressively ranked. I have him 20th overall this year, and that's I think about five slots ahead of ADP as it stands right now.
I had him 40th, which means I actually had him below the slot there by a couple of picks, but I didn't mind it at all. That was an eminently fair pick. You know, we could have went with, looking at my rankings, like someone I would have maybe liked there that I have ranked more aggressively than you, Brett, because of the position, was Robinson Cano, and Cano went the pick before Springer. So yeah, that was an easy call for me, and I didn't have a problem with it.
Yeah, and you know, for all the talk that he's a batting average sink, I mean, he reduced his strikeouts pretty handily last year. He only had 109 strikeouts in 451 plate appearances, which was a vast improvement over 114 in 345 the year before. And he hit 276. He can do that. He can do that again. And if he hits 276, he's actually a positive contributor in a 15-team mix, and it's not even all that close.
Yeah, but and if Springer hits 250, which even if that's more realistic, he'll run enough, he'll hit for power enough, he's in a solid lineup, a contending team, he'll score runs, he'll drive in runs, he'll still be valuable.
Oh, absolutely. I just think people are still anchoring him as that 240 to 250 hitter.
You know, from a comparable standpoint, if you look at Jose Bautista, who went around earlier, you know, right before Arrieta, better power granted, but Springer's like a Bautista light with speed and going around later.
Yeah, that is fair. I think the two of them are very similarly valued.
Yeah, I'd rather Bautista, but I don't think that, given the difference, the gap there, that's a good value.
Mm-hmm. So speaking of good values, then our fourth round pick was someone who, you know, even though he's been slipping, I did not think he was going to still be around, and the huge pitching run certainly helped keep him on the board. I mean, we had as the picks were slowly winding down towards ours in the fourth, we were kind of staring at two outfielders that we collectively really like above where they're going. The decision was kind of made for us when Paul and Jason took Carlos Gomez, I think two spots ahead of us. So that left us with Adam Jones. And I have zero complaints about getting Adam Jones in the fourth round. I think the whispers of his demise are greatly exaggerated. He's still going to be just 30 years old pretty much all season. His batting average slipped a little bit last year, but you know, everything else was still there. The power was all still, everything was there. He's not going to be a double digit stolen base guy anymore, but at fourth round value, that's not a big deal at all.
I get the concerns with the injuries with him. You know, he missed some time last year. He missed, it was a various of maladies. So you discount him, but there's a difference between discounting from the late first round where Jones has been going to like end of the second, meaning the third, and dropping him all the way to the fourth. He's going to produce enough at that phase of the draft where you're looking at a bargain. And you can kind of see the theme for us that the first couple rounds were players who I think were par, were decent. We get the third baseman we want in a soft third base draft. We get the ace, but then we get two values. And at this point, you look at the anchors on our offense and you look at the ace, and already compared to some other teams, I really like our team. Yeah, it would have been great if Gomez fell to us. But honestly, I was surprised he even fell that far, that he was two picks away from where we could have picked. I would have been a happy dance with Gomez over Jones, but I was perfectly fine landing Adam Jones there.
Yeah, I think both of – I'm trying to see where we had Jones. We had them back-to-back in our rankings, but still we had them at 40 and 41.
Yeah, I had Cruz a slot ahead of Jones. You had who went right before Nelson Cruz, right for Adam Jones. I had Nelson Cruz a slot ahead of Jones. You had Jones six slots ahead of Cruz. Where did I have Gomez? I had Gomez. We both had Gomez ahead of. Actually, I had Jones ahead of Gomez too. So I think I believed in Jones more than you did, just from that. He's a guy people look at and are discounting too much. And in some ways, it's not just the injuries. He's being discounted because in reality, the on-base percentage is poor. But labor is a batting average league. And I understand his limitations in real life. And in labor, I don't care about the on-base percentage.
Yep, completely agree. This is actually an interesting time to bring up the squad, but I went out to Twitter earlier to get a couple of see if anyone had any questions they wanted us to answer, and got a question from Matt who asked us what our biggest disagreements were during the draft and how we made those decisions. We've talked a little bit about process, but I want to answer this question because I think it's. I think we work a little bit differently than some other partner teams probably do. Our discussions are all more or less going into where our rankings end up, where our consolidated rankings end up. So we put together top 150 lists and we consolidated them, and then we kind of discussed them and then we tweaked them a little bit, and then we had the list. And the nice thing about drafting with Mike is that Mike has the same approach to drafts and auctions that I do. And once we have the list, and we both know that there's going to have to be a pretty good reason to go too far off the list until we get pretty deep in the draft. And, I think there's, this is our third year doing this together. We've been writing together for longer. I think the comfortability of, me knowing that if Mike wants to draft someone, that I have the utmost trust that his decision making is sound, and that I think he has. Similar trust in me, at least I hope, and that really becomes the basis for our decisions. So we had literally zero arguments during the draft about who to take, and it's pretty rare to be able to run a team with someone and have that happen, which is nice.
The other thing about having the list, so what we do is we each rank our top 150. And we average those out and come up with a composite ranking. And what I found about that helps, it takes Brett's, the guys he's really high on or the guys I'm really high on. Sometimes we're both high on a guy and we're going to get him. But in many cases, it takes a guy one of us is high on. And if we get that guy, we kind of recognize in the moment it's a bargain. Springer was a good example of that. So I'm a little lower on Springer than Brett. But when I see him come in, where it's like, okay, like even with my downgrading of Springer, he's still our highest rated player. That tells me something. That tells me that, well, even with my downgrading of Springer, you're still looking at a bargain at this point in the draft. And, it didn't work out in 2015, but that was what happened with Adam Wainwright. Whereas as much as I was kind of around ADP or a little bit below ADP on Wainwright, I looked at where he was and it's like, well, it's kind of impossible not to take him. And you don't go through that thing. And this is where the rankings work. I think some people do this by feel. By doing this a little bit more methodically, it takes that discussion away where we're not convincing ourselves, I like somebody, and the other person's like, well, you know, I don't like him. You know, he's not as good. And makes it a more methodical approach.
Yeah. So we've each had our hand in where the rankings are, and it's an even hand, and we know what the deal is. It's pretty straightforward, and it makes it a lot more simple to evaluate. And we're not really, you know, we can have discussions around the team without having discussions around the valuation, because we've already done that.
Yeah, and to get into the other, I mentioned methodology. To get in the other side of this, something I've gotten better at working with Brett is I've always been a very methodical person. Working with you, Brett, has given me more, it's improved my feel, or trusting my feel, and having a moment, we'll get into some picks later, it's like, okay, this guy's not the highest on our board, but based on how our team looks, we should take him.
Yep, and we will definitely get there. So that was a nice little sidetrack for our thought process and methodology. So let's talk about our round five pick, because this has been a running I want to say joke, but the word I'm looking for is much more depressing than joke. I don't even know what that word is, but we have drafted five relievers in our 2 years of labor. And, Mike, tell the audience how many saves we have gotten from, those five relievers in total.
I'm pretty sure it's zero, unless I'm missing something. So our first year, our team got one save, and it was from Dellin Betances, who we didn't draft. And then last year we got a bunch of saves, but it was from being aggressive through FAB, and we made a trade. So yeah, every reliever we've drafted has bombed. And some of that is the first year, the first reliever we took was in the 12th round. Last year we decided that if we don't take one early, we're just going to speculate late, which it's the philosophy. If you're not get saves, or if you might not get saves, don't mess around in the middle rounds. Yeah, this year we went a different direction. We ranked some guys aggressively, and we thought we'd get at least one and maybe two.
Yeah, and we got – it was nice. We got the top closer on our board. He went as the third closer off the board, and that was Wade Davis of the Royals. He is an absolute machine. As far as confidence in closers go, I have about as much confidence in Davis as I can have in a closer, which, you know, is obviously, there's a governor on that, but, I feel really good about him being able to put up a, you know, sub 1.5 ERA, sub, you know, 0.85 whip, and strike out a whole bunch of guys and save however many games, 40, 45 games. He's the guy. I mean, I don't know if you feel as strongly about him being the guy as I do, but I feel pretty strongly about that.
Yeah, he's the guy for me too. I you know, the one thing I'll say to confirm what you're saying, there's no Mariano Rivera closer or post Mariano Rivera closer who's automatic. Anybody can lose their job, and it, you know, it's some of the fallacy in these expert drafts where closers get taken early and there's a hierarchy. And this is where with us getting knocked in the past, I've been defensive, where it's like, well, closers are just bad investments. So like a third of them or so lose their jobs, and it's not linear. It's not just the bad ones that lose their jobs. The good ones can suddenly have a bad week or bad three games and lose their job, or have someone come up behind them who's simply better, as Davis did last year with Greg Holland, who was hurt, and Holland was certainly a high pick. But, yeah, I feel safer with – relative to the position, I feel as safe with Davis as I'm going to feel with a closer.
Yeah, I agree with that. We've been doing a lot of talking. So George, you haven't talked at all. How do you feel about Davis? Do you think he's the top closer that should be drafted this year?
Hey guys. Yeah, I do. I don't have a whole lot of concern with Davis, and One of the important variables that you mentioned was guys coming up behind him. They really only have Kelvin Herrera in that bullpen. He was outstanding in the playoffs. He looked great down the stretch, but he's not a guy who's going to assume the closer role. Greg Holland is gone. They have nobody else. And I think they're going to lean heavily here on Davis this year. And you look at the other guys who went ahead of Davis, Craig Kimbrell of the Red Sox and Kenley Jansen with the Dodgers. On skills alone, you could argue that they're probably just as good, if not maybe better. But Davis, from a workload standpoint and a results standpoint over the last two seasons, he's arguably been statistically the most dominant reliever in the game. So I don't have a problem with it. I just think literally every player is a risk, and I don't think there's as safe of an investment as there is at the closer spot as you're going to get with Wade Davis. He's money in the bank as far as I'm concerned.
Yep. So now this leads us into a really interesting stretch of two picks between the sixth and seventh round, one of whom has been talked about plenty on the internets and on some other podcasts. I mean, it's a very divisive player, but we will get there. Why, Mike? What's your best guess as to why, with all the third basemen going early, that Matt Carpenter was still there in the sixth round? And walk us through our logic in taking him, even though we already had a third baseman in Machado.
Well, there's a few things. One, people don't know what to make of Carpenter. He's older than you think. He's not a young player, even though he hasn't been up long. And he's somebody, I believe, regardless of whether the power is all there or if it's just more of a 270 hitter with 15 home run power, there's enough value there, particularly given some of the third basemen that went before him, like Evan Longoria and Adrian Beltre, that he's at the very least comparable to those players and should be productive. So I looked at Carpenter. He wasn't the most exciting pick there, but I looked at him like a pick who is going to be appropriate to the sixth round. The second piece was that the Fangraphs team of Jason Klett and Paul Sporer, they mentioned this in their podcast about drowning the pool with Carlos Correa and Francisco Lindor. I wanted to do that a little bit at third base and put some pressure on people to kind of make some decisions at third earlier than they would have. That didn't really work out, in part because Beltre and Longoria went earlier. But then the third piece, and this is sort of overlooked, first base isn't as strong as it's been. So with some of the first basemen off the board, and we talked about this while we were drafting, some years you don't want to go with two third basemen. I was fine with doing so because I didn't think there'd be two first basemen there for us sitting there at value. And as the way our draft went, that was right. We didn't take a first baseman until the 15th round.
No, and I think that's the important distinction to make with first base is that there are a lot of really high-end first basemen. But the middle of the first base tier is pretty soft, and the strength of first base is in the elite guys and in the seemingly never ending depth of the outside the top 15 guys. And you know, we looked at Carpenter against the next like 5 to 7 first basemen that were on our board and where we thought they might go. And, you know, he didn't look like a bad option at corner infield compared to them, especially given the risks of some of the first basemen that went later. I mean, they're looking at the draft, the next three first basemen that went after Matt Carpenter was Albert Pujols in the seventh, who has no shortage of risk for this year. Even though I think that was a pretty good spot for Doug Anderson to take him. Lucas Duda, who went in the ninth, and then Byung-ho Park in the 11th.
Look at you laughing at Park.
I can't even say. I just the thought of drafting him would make me have to go take a shower.
Well, and the funny thing about Duda is, as aggressive as I was or felt about him, that pick there, I don't want to say it was aggressive, but even by my strong valuation of Duda, that was appropriate. So that was about as high as I would have went on Duda is at the end of the ninth round. And given that we weren't at the end of the round, you know, he's somebody, if he came back in the 10th, I would have considered him. But yeah, people were being strong on those first basemen, I think way too strong on Park. But even Pujols and Duda, I know George likes Pujols. At best, those were appropriate valuations because first base is thinner than usual.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk about the big name in our draft. And at this point, a number of our listeners probably know already, in the seventh round with the let me do this right, the 97th pick, we selected Billy Hamilton, the erstwhile stolen base king. And there have been no shortage of opinions on this pick. I've heard both positive and negative. I've heard both positive and negative within the same site, which is interesting. And it's, you know, I'll give the 15-second spiel. Neither Mike nor I think were particularly high on Hamilton, nor did we come into this draft either particularly wanting him or particularly thinking we were going to get him. I was a little bit more aggressive on Hamilton in my ranking than Mike was. But, you know, this gets into the argument that you start hearing a lot with players like Hamilton, which is, you know, Hamilton is terrible. He shouldn't be drafted. He's a bad player. That is lazy analysis at its best. If you don't think Billy Hamilton is a, you know, fifth round pick or a seventh round pick or a ninth round pick, that's fine. But there is always somewhere where the value makes sense. And if we were really high on Hamilton, that might have been in the fifth round. I heard, I saw Mike Podorzer talking about his valuations and how he had Hamilton rated very highly again this year and held off because he had taken D. Gordon in the second round, which you know, was a strong pick at the time.
Mike was kind of kicking himself, given how far Hamilton fell. He was kicking himself after the fact. Although I would say of our drafters, he was in the minority.
Yeah, he was in the minority.
It's worth noting he also took him in the second round last year.
He did,
and I think he said he had him as a top 25 player this year, just according to his valuations.
Well, yeah, and this is a separate discussion for another day. But Mike tends to value steals. I think some people undervalue steals from a valuation standpoint. Mike probably is somewhat in the other direction where he overvalues them. But that's part of why we got Hamilton where we did. I think a lot of people look at players who are one-trick ponies and steal and say, oh, they're worth nothing. I can get those guys in the free agent pool. And there might have been a point where that was true, but the number of players – forget Hamilton's output. The number of players who can steal 30 or more bases, they just don't exist the way they did even 5 years ago.
No, they absolutely do not. And – there, you know, yeah, this goes back to the way that people view all X category players the same. When you kind of break it down, you have people who, you know, say, oh, Billy Hamilton is a two category player. But, you know, a lot of players are two category players, and most of them have nowhere near the potential impact that Hamilton has on one of those two categories. It's, you know, it's a rotisserie league. It's, you know, we know how the scoring goes, and there's no way that you can say that there is not an appropriate place to take Hamilton, even if you think there's a good chance he's going to lose his starting job, which I don't agree with. But even Hamilton as a part-time player or as a player who plays for a little while and then ends up a part-time player is still a likely a 40 to 50 steal guy. And that's, you know, that's it's not to be, it can be overstated, but it's not to be understated.
George and I were, before you joined, Brett, and before we started recording, George and I talked about this, and the part about Hamilton that I guess infuriates me, and I'm on the record, I'm not a fan of Hamilton this year. His ADP, and it may have changed today, but entering labor, Hamilton's ADP was 74 in NFBC, which is a couple rounds or a round and a half lower than where we got him. I wouldn't have taken him that high if we had that slot, you know, a couple rounds before. I would have said no, you know, it's too much, and that's about where we, a little after we got Davis, you know, it would have been Carpenter. So, you know, in the sixth round, I wouldn't have taken Hamilton. I would have said that's too soon. But in the next round, you look at it and you're like, you know, I get it. There's downside on him, but there's downside on almost every player outside of the first round. And then that's the part that drives me nuts. You could, like Carlos Gomez, I believe in the upside. Don't get me wrong. I'm a big fan of him. I think that was a good pick. He could be hurt again. The injuries that he had last year could be chronic, and he could earn 15th round value. And I'm not saying of Gomez. There are a lot of players like that just because they're baseball players and everybody has downside. To focus solely on Hamilton's downside and ignore everything else, that I think is – I think there's a fallacy there.
Yep.
There seems to be just this huge blind spot in the industry regarding Hamilton because, yes, he's a terrible hitter. He's not good, but he's an excellent fantasy player. I mean, we've talked about it a little bit in the past, but last year he was a top 20 outfielder, Mike, in your standard mixed league valuations with a .274 on base percentage in 454 plate appearances. I mean, the floor is incredibly high given his skill set and what he actually brings to the table and the relative lack of speed in the game. I just don't get what people are missing here. And Brett touched on it, but I think the concerns about him losing playing time are a little bit overblown. He was a Gold Glove caliber center fielder in 2014, and he's solid defensively. He's 25 years old. The Reds have to see they're in a rebuilding mode, so they're not a playoff team where they can afford to bench him for a veteran. I think they need to find out whether or not he can get on base enough to justify playing every day or whether he needs to be relegated to a bench role long term. He's going to get the at-bats this year, and if you just look at the Pecota projections for this season, I mean, his 50th percentile projection, this is with a .285 on base percentage, has him stealing 66 bases in 600 plate appearances. And we could easily see more. He improved significantly with his base running last year. Not only was his success rate on stolen base attempts up to 88% from 71% the year before, but based on our base running metric, base running runs at BP, it's a technical stat, but he had one of the five best base running seasons in the last decade last year, and that was in only 157 on-base opportunities. So he's just historically good at what he does, and to not understand that from a fantasy standpoint, I struggle to grasp how that's happening right now this year. I really do. You can't argue with the value at this point in the draft, given what his actual upside is in the seventh round. You can't do it.
Yeah. You be you, George. I think you feel the strongest of Hamilton of the three of us here, but I think, you know, we've talked about this. I think enough at this point. We could have a whole,
yeah, we can go on for another 20 minutes and do the Billy Hamilton podcast, but we've all made our points, and we feel strongly enough that even me as the most negative person about Hamilton at the seventh round in a 15-team draft where you're close to the 100th pick, I actually had Jason Kipnis above Hamilton on my board or on our aggregate board. And we'll get into this later, but I looked at Kipnis as like, you know what? The other side of this argument, Hamilton has more of a rotisserie ceiling than Kipnis, and I was willing to take that.
He also has more of a rotisserie floor than Kipnis.
Yeah, well.
But we're now getting into the point where we're going to talk about Billy Hamilton for a half hour, and that probably should
happen. We should probably. Well, we can do that. We're going to talk about outfitters next week, so we can revisit. Sorry, visit Billy Hamilton. We talk about outfielders. If you know, you leave a lot of comments on, you know, iTunes and all the wonderful places that this is. Just to
play. Yes. I mentioned one question we got on Twitter before. I want to ask this question before we talk about our next pick because I think this is the time it was most applicable. Nori asked us who the players that we targeted that were air quotes stolen by other teams and how we rebounded. You know, I think with our strategy, I think this type of stuff doesn't really affect us all that much because there aren't specific players that we're targeting. I mean, if we're high on players, they get roped into better spots in our consolidated rankings, but that, you know, that doesn't necessarily mean that we're targeting them in the draft. We're just going down and making sure that we have the right guys valued ahead of the wrong guys. As far as rebounds go, I mean, we're moving down to the next guy on the list. So there's not much time for reflection and disappointment. That said, the eighth round is the one instance of the time where we were looking at someone in the queue who we were hoping would slip because he was a really strong value at that point. And he kept getting closer and closer and closer. And then he was taken a pick before us in the eighth round by Jake Seeley of Roto Experts. And that was Ian Desmond. Mike, did I, for my weeks of prodding before the labor draft, to get you to raise your ranking on Ian Desmond, did that make you at least a little sad when we missed out on him? I mean, we turned around and grabbed Brian McCann, who we both really like anyway. So we were sad for about 10 seconds, but, it was 10 seconds more sadness than I was hoping for.
I was hopeful we get Desmond cause you did. I didn't raise my ranking to all the way where you had it, because otherwise I think we might have taken or may have taken Desmond where we took Hamilton. You had Desmond ranked 82. I think I moved him up from about 110 to 94, but in our aggregate that put him right there in the eighth round. And when Mike Podhorzer took Elvis Andrus, I had a suspicion that was going to lead to another shortstop being taken, and Desmond with the cloud surrounding Jose Reyes was the next best one on the board. And that's exactly what happened. You know, Jake took Desmond. We didn't really even hesitate long. We looked at McCann where we had him ranked. Going back to last year, we our catchers were Derek Norris and Wellington Castillo. Castillo worked out, but I think we both agreed coming in that we wanted to have a stronger catcher. So our rankings are more aggressive, and we got McCann. And I'm fine with that. I'm fine with 20 to 25 home runs, albeit with a soft average at catcher.
Yeah, we talked beforehand about whether the way we put together our rankings would net us a closer or a catcher in the first 10 rounds. And, you know, I think we thought we were pretty confident that it would based on what we put together, and it did. McCann, I think, was the third catcher. Was he the third catcher on my board? Heading into, I have him. Yeah, I had him just ahead of Jonathan Lucroy. Looks like you did as well. He was for me. He was the number three catcher behind Posey and Schwarber, and that was a good spot.
I had him fourth. I had Sal Perez a slot ahead of him. So it was close.
Sounds good. McCann's pretty straightforward. I think he's got a good chance for close to 25 homers, strong RBI numbers, and batting average that won't completely melt our soul. But then in the ninth round, we grabbed another starting pitcher. And this one, we actually had a sort of a three-way grouping in our rankings. And this is where we started to – this was the first pick. I think we went off of our rankings slightly. But it was more because I think we were a little – considering, and I'll try not to speak for you, Mike, but my thought process is that we had Carlos Martinez ranked slightly ahead of Michael Wacha in our aggregate rankings. They were both available in our ninth round for our ninth round pick. And given the fact that whoever we took was going to be our second starter at that point, I felt more comfortable with a little more safety. And, you know, I like Martinez a lot. I've liked him for a long time, but there's a bigger injury risk with Martinez, and there's already talk about how he's not throwing at full strength because of his shoulder soreness from the end of last season. And while I agree that that's probably an overblown thing at this point, it was just enough to swing my vote to the opposite direction. And I think, you know, Mike, did you have Wacha ranked ahead of Martinez in your ranks anyway?
No, anything, I was more aggressive of Martinez this year than you were. And we talked about this at the moment. And what we talked about was, and you kind of brought me over to this, if we had taken, say, Wainwright in the sixth round instead of Carpenter, if Wainwright had been there, and we had two starters, we probably would have taken Martinez because we would have looked at it like, well, we have two starters. You know, I know Wainwright might not be a 200 inning guy either, but his injury last year wasn't an arm injury. He should still be 170, 180. We have Arrieta. We'll take the guy with the higher ceiling and the guy who wows us over someone who may pitch more innings. We had one starter. We wanted someone with a little more stability at that point. You're in the ninth round. No one here is really an extreme innings eater. Jeff Samardzija went a pick before Wacha. He would have been, I don't think we would have taken him there. But you're getting to this point where so many pitchers are 170, 180 versus, you know, 200, the workhorses. But yeah, we wanted to make sure we're getting innings at this point and as well as ceiling. So we strayed from our rankings and we took Wacha.
Yep. And I am still feeling good about that decision. I feel, especially with the way the rest of the draft shook out, I feel more comfortable having a little bit safer of an option there.
Yeah, I would agree.
I said there were three. The other guy that was there, the way this worked out is that we had Wacha, Martinez, and Marcus Stroman right at the top of our queue at that point, and we took Wacha, then Jake took Carlos Martinez, and then Paul and Jason took Marcus Stroman. So they all went off the board back to back.
Funny aside is that I know that Paul Sporer was really high on Wacha, and that was some of my thinking there as well. And based on where he was ranked, if I didn't know that, I might have tried to wait until the 10th round on him and taken someone else. But I knew that if we didn't take him, that Paul would have.
Yeah. So then that brings us to our round 10 pick and a player who I genuinely believe there's no way he should have still been there. And, you know, next to Springer, this was probably my second favorite pick of the draft. And that was Hanley Ramirez. Everybody knows the drawbacks of Hanley Ramirez at this point. You know, we know he was just a really terrible baseball player last year when you factor in the butcher job that he did in left field. But with that said, you know, we talk about, you know, we feel like we talk about this every episode now. We talk about the National League to American League transition, and it can be challenging for some players. But, you know, it's not challenging forever. There is an adjustment period and players usually get past it. And, you know, the struggles that Hanley had I think had a little bit to do with the move to Boston, a little bit to do with the position thing, which is another thing we've talked about. They were asking him to play outfield, which is a position that was very foreign to him. You know, we talked about this with Kyle Schwarber a little bit at the end of last year, talked about how his offense went down a little bit when he started playing offense rather than playing outfield rather than playing catcher. You know, players take their defensive struggles with them to the plate, and it certainly seemed like Hanley did that last year. He, even with all those struggles, he played in 105 games and still hit 19 homers, stole 6 bases, scored 59 runs, drove in 53. So, you know, the batting average is a risk. I think, you know, based on his contact numbers, I think 249 was lower than what we can expect going forward. But I think the downside, aside from the usual injury risk with Hanley Ramirez, is way overblown here. And, you know, he'll have dual eligibility in a week or two. And that is just icing on the cake. That's enough of me talking about Hanley Ramirez. But I was
yeah, not much to add. Same thing, you know, similar to Hamilton, wasn't targeting Ramirez. We had him ranked around where his ADP was, and you reach a point where, you know, over 150 picks in the draft, there's almost nothing but value there. Yes, he could get hurt. I just don't think he'll fall off the map entirely, and the labor rules in some leagues, it's a long in season requirement. In labor, it's 5 games. Hanley could very well be our first baseman or a corner infielder for us if someone else went down after a week. And we didn't know who we were taking at first later on. So we looked at it like, well, we don't take a first baseman. We could take an awful first baseman at the end and just have to suck along with that guy for a week. So that was part of the rationale of that pick too. There was a savvy user on Twitter who I think pointed that out as I noticed it. He's like, what's the in-game eligibility? You're looking at Hanley at first base, aren't you? Because I think Yancey Eaton had said, what are you guys going to do at first base? And, you know, I wasn't even thinking about that with Hanley, but that worked out as well.
Yeah, it worked out. And I have seen all of the pictures of him looking svelte at spring training again. It's, you know, it's fun. It's that time of year. It's the time of year where people are allowed to get
excited. In the 10th round of a 15-team mix, though, Hanley can play 110 games. He's averaging like 108 the last 3 years. He can play 110 games, and we'll have a replacement for 2 months. If he hits 20 home runs and hits 260 and is first base eligible, that's fine.
Look, and we'll get to it later, but you know, this is part of the reason why we took, I think it's part of the reason why we took one outfielder. I don't really count because he's going to start the year in the minors, but we took Colby Rasmus in the reserve round. And if we get 100 games of Hanley Ramirez and we pair that with 50 games of Colby Rasmus, that is a pretty darn good outfielder.
Yeah, even some of the players, you know, we did a good job last year with it, but even some of the players that are going to come through the free agent transom, we'll be okay.
Yeah. So for those of you sitting along at home thinking, oh my God, they're going to talk about all their draft picks
left this,
and we're going to be here for another 2 hours.
You can't stop listening, but actually don't stop listening. We love you.
Yeah. So we're gonna speed through the rest of the draft just because the top 10 picks are the most interesting. We're just gonna pick our spots here. So the next 3 pitchers that came off the board, I wrote about this in our write up that went up, but this is not the first time we've taken 3 starters in a row. This is clearly not gonna work out as well as our 3 starters in a row that we took in 7, 8, 9 last year, who listeners of this show.
But hopefully it'll work out better than 2014, which I'm not supposed to ever talk about again. So if it works out somewhere in the middle, that'll be okay.
This is true. So our 11, 12, and 13 were James Shields, Asashi Iwakuma, and Carlos Rodon. I think all 3 of them have really strong, some of them feel like floor plays, but they're really upside plays too. Shields and it would not surprise me at all if Shields and Iwakuma pulled off a top 20 season. Iwakuma, it's really all about health, and you know, we're not in round 12, you're not counting on him throwing 210 innings just because that's extremely unlikely to happen. Shields bouncing back, I think, is a pretty strong possibility. I think he got pretty unlucky last year, and the defense looks to be a little bit better in San Diego this year. Rodon's really the only guy with the true youth upside that that we were gambling on a little bit last year. But I really, really like Rodon, and he was extremely sharp down the stretch. So I'm happy with the way all of those pitching pitchers worked out. But the interesting thing is, and I'll throw this out to Mike to talk about, is that, you know, when round 11 started, we had no middle infield at all. We had no second baseman, no shortstop, no middle infielder. And we could have reached at that point and gone off of our rankings, and we didn't. And it, I don't know how confident we were that it wasn't going to turn around and bite us. And it certainly didn't. But Mike, why don't you talk about what we ended up doing with middle infield and how those guys felt.
Well, to preface it, there were points, you know, I talked about Kipnis earlier, that there were points where we discussed middle infielders. We discussed Dustin Pedroia in the 11th. We decided Shields was a better value, and that Pedroia, even with our relatively aggressive ranking on him, was a 12th round pick. He went to FNTSY, Doug Anderson, on the other side of the 12th before us. Daniel Murphy, who you like, Brett, also went in the 12th to Razzball. Addison Russell, who I think I liked more than you did, we considered the 11th, but we took Shields. So there were a bunch of players like that who we could have taken but weren't at the top of our aggregate rankings. And you were more confident in this than I was. You know, I think even a couple rounds before we took him, you mentioned Neil Walker as a possibility in the 16th. Or like, I shouldn't say the round, but you know, you mentioned his possibility. I was like, oh, you know, I don't think he'll get to us, and he did. He, you know, he got to us in the 16th round, and we then got Marcus Semien in the 17th round. And I look at those two guys, and it's like, I'm not in love with either one of those players, but you're looking at two players who are going to hit 15 home runs. Semien's going to steal a few bases. They both should hit for an average that won't kill you. You know, Walker has a little more upside there. Doesn't run, but at that point in the draft with the offense we had, we didn't need studs. And I think this is something people miss when they reach for players at a position. There were other people who reach for second baseman or shortstop. We were patient. We kind of held to our method, and I think we did fine.
I agree. And then we were able to grab Estrubel Cabrera in the 22nd round for middle infield. He was really our last active player as we made the decision, I think probably around the time we started filling out our middle infield, that we were going to wait until the final pick to grab our second catcher.
Well, you know, we thought we might get Yasmani Grandal because as I said, Brett doesn't rank past 150. I had Grandal ranked 30 slots above ADP because I knew Brett liked him, and another guy I bought into besides Desmond, and Spore and Collette took him in the 11th, which was even more aggressive than I wanted to go. And I'm not knocking them. I mean, I think if you like the guy, that's a fine pick. But, you know, kind of a bit of a snag there. I thought he might be either in the 12th for us, and we'd have the discussion. You know, just went around too early. And, yeah, every other catcher that went, I like Wilson Ramos, but 16th is too early. That was a theme with many of those catchers. Just take it at a place where, okay, I like the guy, but I'd rather get the value in another position. Also, we need the middle infielders. I'm kind of fine with the one position on what's a strong offense being a little soft.
Yeah. So, you know, before we got to those middle infield guys, we did take Byron Buxton in the 14th round. Obviously, that's glimmering upside right there, but with a very, very, not very low floor, because he's going to run, but he's got he's got a lower floor than most of the players in that arena. But then again, he was our fifth outfielder at the time, so I think we felt, I think that allowed us to feel a little bit more comfortable taking that risk.
The other side of that is, and this is where I see people take guys with higher, you know, higher ceiling, lower floor earlier. For all the talk about Billy Hamilton, with guys like Springer and Jones and Carpenter and McCann, players with higher floors kind of allowed us to make that gamble on Buxton. Like if you look at the 14th round, you've got Carlos Santana, you got Johnny Peralta, you've got DJ LeMay, you've got Ben Zobrist. They're all fine players, and I think they're decent picks. But the teams that took them, chances are, had to take them because they made some of their riskier picks earlier.
Yeah, I think that's fair. And we took some safer plays later on. I mean, we took the other two middle of the order guys in New York in Mark Teixeira and Alex Rodriguez in the 15th and the 20th round, respectively. And you know, given where they're going, I think they might not be healthy for the entire season, but they'll play and they'll hit for
value. Yeah, you know, so that's at least and this is the upside conversation. The funny thing about A-Rod, and I don't have it in front of me, but he didn't go that far behind last year coming off a season where he missed the entire year. I think he went like in the 23rd or 24th round. And you know, I get it. Like I kind of get playing the upside game, but this is a player coming off of a 30 plus home run season. I get the age. You know, I get that could have been a fluke year. Maybe he falls off, you know, the map. But in a year that he was suspended, and everybody's wondering, will he be the same? You know, did PEDs have some kind of impact? Now we have the stats to back it up, and we got him about three or four rounds ahead of that perception he had before.
Yeah, it's I was happy with where we got
the Andrew Miller pick. I'm interested in the thought process behind that one. Is that a case of just too good of a value given what he's going to provide ratio wise, or what were you guys thinking on that one? I'm just curious. He was in the
18th round. For me, it was way too good a value to pass up at that point. I mean, we weren't going to take, realistically, I know we have our valuations, and I think in my valuation sense, I think Andrew Miller is more valuable than either Neil Walker or Marcus Semien, but we were never really going to take Miller before we filled out some of that middle infield spot, given what was left on the board. But when he was still there in the 18th, I think I don't think either of us had any thoughts.
We've had a good history in the league, and you know, we didn't draft him, but I mentioned Betances the first year. In this kind of league, I like having a middle reliever or a setup guy, even if he isn't going to get saves, it is going to be, you know, that kind of anchor. You know, no one knows what's going to happen with Aroldis Chapman, and I'm skeptical that even if he is suspended, he gets a long suspension. And that wasn't the bet there. The bet is that even if Chapman is with the Yankees for 162 games, Miller could still get like 5, 6, 7 saves in that bullpen just because of the way that bullpen is going to be structured, and beyond that, produce like silly value.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's really the draft. I mean, beyond that, we got some.
You're not going to talk about
some upside in Andrew Heaney and Trevor Bauer. I've talked about Jerks and Profar a lot.
Do you have a pillow? Do you have a pillow about, with his face on it?
We grab Zach Wheeler. I should get one.
It might not help.
Your might help me sleep better.
One of those ceiling posters.
Something like that. Heaney, Bauer, and Zach Wheeler were kind of upside plays in pitching. We took some safer options later on in the reserve round with R.A. Dickey and C.J. Wilson. Then on the hitting side, obviously, with the jokes, yes, we took Jerks and Profar in the 24th round. I still think that's a really good pick. I think he's going to play. I want him to be healthy very badly.
Well,
if he's not,
you know, I was listening to, I think it was RotoWire. So Todd Zola did his labor recap. Well, it was Masters Ball, so he did his labor recap. But before that, he was talking about Profar, and you know, he made the point that when Giancarlo Stanton and Profar were coming up, they're being talked about like together. And he says, obviously that's silly now, but people have gone too far the other way on Profar, where people forget the ability that's there. And with the Hamilton injury and with the idea that Profar could play somewhere besides second base, there is that good possibility if he's healthy. And even if he's in on the DL for a month or the minors for a month, he could still make an impact at some point this season. And again, it's a reserve pick. We talked about this last year. If it doesn't work out, you live with the upside. Another thing about Labor to point out before we go or wrap this up, it's not like some leagues, like an ESPN standard league or a Yahoo standard league, where it's a limited DL and you have to drop guys and make choices or clog up your reserve with them. So we looked at that this year, and that's part of the reason we took Zach Wheeler. It's part of the reason we took Jerickson Profar. We actually considered Homer Bailey, but someone else took him at the end. Having those players to just stash and then make a pickup can really pay off. It paid off for us last year, actually. So,
yeah.
Since we're wrapping up, you know, just to kind of do the wrap up thing, you know, I'll start with George because, you know, George, you haven't talked much. I know you're giving us a lot of leeway, and we appreciate it. You have the outside view. What do you think of this team? Like, what if you were coming into a league and looking at this team? Like, I know you're biased, but do you like this team? Do you think it's a competitive squad?
I do. I especially like building the foundation with Manny Machado, given what he provides across five categories. I think we touched on it when we did our third base preview, but he really checks all the boxes right now. I don't think there's a better building block. If you're looking at them, not necessarily the middle of the first round, but you're not getting Trout or Harper or Goldschmidt, I think he's the next guy that you really look at and you'd like to have as your foundational piece. And the element that I like about the draft overall is that you didn't go into it with the mindset, we think we're going to reach, you know, reach is a subjective term. It's about valuations and where you think of, what do you think a player is worth? So you never fault someone for reaching, but you didn't go into it saying we're targeting this specific player. It's more along the lines of we're going to let everything play out. And we have an idea of what we think each player is worth, and we're going to take the values as they come. So I like that. You see that in the third and fourth round there with the Jones and Springer picks. It's letting the draft come to you. You can't go into it with a set strategy of going, we're going to do X, we're going to do plan these specific things, and they have to adjust on the fly. You talked about it. You didn't do a whole lot of adjusting. It was if you did, it was late when you're in the 16th round. You're going, all right, now we need to pick up a middle infield.
But even then, having confidence in our values and the ebb and flow of the draft, it allowed us to know whether it was Walker or Semien or whoever it was that we were going to wind up with some solid picks there and not be in a position where it's like, oh my God, like we're going to have nothing at middle infield. And you know, we had that discussion, but we're not going to panic. We're going to take the pitchers like we did in 11 through 13, you know, even Buxton, we're going to take Buxton and not worry about what's going to happen later on. And yeah, I think the process that Brett and I talk about, that's kind of what's so important. You have to have some flexibility. You can't be completely rigid and say, you know, we have to take this player because he's our highest guy on the board. But if you stick to that sense of valuation, it really pays off. So Brett, what do you – I know, you know, this will be up tomorrow. Like, PFM thinks our team is the best. And, you know, it's kind of a joke because if you're – I've done something wrong. But we didn't draft off of the PFM. You know, we kind of use our own rankings and look at the PFM after the fact. If we did just draft off of the PFM, particularly in the last third of the draft, our team would probably look even stronger. Right, but there's two other systems out there, I think, that have us like first or second. So I think across the board, it's not just us. I really do believe that it's, again, going back to the beginning of the show, events can play out, things cannot work out, but the foundation is strong.
Yeah, I think there are some really good teams in this draft. I think it showed up in a lot of the projection stuff that I've seen, but I think Todd Zola drafted a really strong team. I think I hate to say it because he's our, I joke, he's our bitter rival. Shouldn't be surprising to anyone that, that I think, Fred Zinke's team is, looks excellent after the draft.
That top three is awesome.
He's likely already working on 5 trades anyway. But there are strong teams all around. There are teams with lots of upside. Look at the upside that's up and down Jeff Erickson's team. His team is a little bit more of a win or go home team, and
toward bottom and went upside. He did take Joc Pederson in the 11th round, but at that point is a good pick. He almost went the other way this year. He took a number of players. He has Giancarlo Stanton, Jose Bautista, Matt Harvey, and Nelson Cruz in the first 4 rounds. He took a number of players where his team is solid. And, David Wright, who, we're talking about a later pick, Domingo Santana, Pablo Sandoval, some of those guys bounce back. He took Joey Gallo in the 23rd round. He could be right up there too. But, yeah, to your point, Brett, it's a strong league. You never really see somebody come out with a complete clunker because you're talking about 15 people or 14 competitors who are really good.
Yeah, that's a huge point. Yeah. I mean, there aren't one or two people who, even
in the best home leagues, there's usually one or two people where you're like, yeah, they know baseball, but their fantasy acumen isn't quite there. You're just not going to get that flavor.
These are the best in the business. And, I think a good point that I didn't mention earlier, but you ended up with two, I think, pretty polarizing players when you look at them in terms of Wade Davis and Billy Hamilton. I think a lot of people go with a set strategy saying, all right, I want to get this guy because of the steals, or I want to get a closer early. You didn't go in with that mindset. You kind of let the draft come to you, and that's where the value fell. So I think that's the greater point that I was trying to make earlier, that I like that was the approach going into it.
Yeah, I think that's fair, and I think that's a good point to end with. Although I'd be remiss to end without saying a thank you to a friend of the podcast, Steve Gardner.
We'll have to have
us having us be a part of this league. So with that, I don't even know. We're not gonna take a break again. We've been talking for long enough. So this is the end. This has been episode 78 of Flags Fly Forever. You've been listening to me, Brett, Mike, George. Find us on Twitter, find us at baseballperspectus.com. Come and listen to us next week talk about outfielders and probably talk about Billy Hamilton again. We will continue to put up all of our positional series coverage on baseballperspectus.com. So read that. Go listen to all the other podcasts that have come out about labor. It's fun to listen to. There are a lot of good ones out there. But with that, ours is over.
Bye, everybody.
We will see you next week. Good night.